This program is supported in part by Central Washington University in Ellensburg, a member of the Western Undergraduate Exchange. Visit them on the web at cwu.edu.
Welcome to Deadline 24/7, The News Business, a series of programs examining the media from a consumer's point of view, hosted by George Cole. Tonight, ethics and the news media. In an era of breaking news and a reporter's need for access, do ethics fall through the safety net? Joining in on this discussion are Karen Dornsteel of the Spokesman Review, journalism professor Dan Foley, and media critic Larry Calley. And now, Deadline 24/7, The News Business.
And today, we're coming to you live from Spokane in the studios at KPBX and KSFC and live from Billings and Yellowstone Public Radio. Welcome all. In a few moments, your calls and opinions will be welcome. The number, 800-441-2941. Tonight, ethics and the news media. During the next hour, we'll talk about a growing concern about conflicts of interest in the news media. For example, compromise by reporters so they maintain an access to power, whether it's in the White House or a corporate CEO's office. The ongoing struggle between reporters and news consumers about point-of-view journalism. Is it too common? Is it an ethical question when a newspaper, in this case the New York Times, sits on a story, refuses to publish the Bush domestic spying story for a full year because of so-called national security interests? Or, as the Society of Professional Journalists notes in its code of ethics, seek truth and report it. Is it really that simple? What about a newspaper that uses a third party, in this case a computer expert, to set up a sting, to expose the activities of an elected leader? In this case, Jim West, the former mayor of Spokane. Our guests tonight offer perhaps varied opinions. Karen Dornsteel is an investigative reporter with the Spokesman Review. Her award-winning journalism extends from covering the impact of the nuclear industry in Washington State to the recent Jim West story. Karen Dornsteel has her undergraduate degree in history from Stanford, her master's from UC Berkeley. She has lectured extensively at Stanford and elsewhere. Her awards include a George Polk Honor in 1995. By telephone, Dan Foley joins us from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Dan is an associate professor of journalism there. Foley has more than 20 years' experience as a newspaper reporter and editor, 4 years with the Capital Bureau in Helena with Lee Newspapers of Montana. He has worked with the Copley News Service in D.C. and for a brief time on the staff of then-Montana Congressman, now Senator Max Baucus. Dan Foley has a bachelor's degree from the University of Montana. His master's is in journalism from Northwestern. Larry Calley, with us in Spokane, won 4 Emmys as a television reporter and producer with King 5 in Seattle. Calley now works as a media consultant and was a founding member of the Washington News Council, a group which handles complaints about accuracy and fairness in the news media. Calley worked for 27 years with King Television in Seattle. He also has worked as a television journalist in Reno, Las Vegas, and here in Spokane. He's a graduate of the University of Arizona and lives in Seattle. The number to call with your questions, 1-800-441-2941. That's 800-441-2941. Karen Dornsteel, what about the New York Times? Was it an ethical mistake for them to sit on that domestic spying story for a full year?
George, it's hard to second-guess them since they have not explained themselves what they did that for. But as the story is emerging now, in at least by 2004, and before the presidential election in the fall of 2004, the New York Times apparently had this story. The top editors were called to the White House and apparently were talked out of running the story. And the only reason they published it in December of 2005, more than a year later, was one of the two lead reporters, Jim Risen, was just about to publish his own book called State of War, which has an entire chapter on the NSA domestic surveillance program and Bush's role in keeping it secret from Congress and the American public that long.
Dan Foley in Knoxville, Tennessee, you teach journalism. You're in front of journalism students every day. Was this a mistake on the part of the New York Times?
Well, not necessarily. As I understand it, the New York Times explanation for sitting on the story for a year is that they wanted to do more reporting. I certainly don't think that you write a story like this unless you're absolutely sure, and I don't think that you disregard the input from administration officials who say that a revelation of this story could harm the national interest. So I think you want to be very sure that it's accurate, and you want to be very sure that it won't harm the national interest. On the other hand, you don't want to be a victim to leaving something like this unreported when the fact of the eavesdropping itself is harming the national interest in terms of the civil liberties of the U.S. citizens.
Larry Calley, what about your perspective? Is this the tightrope that we heard Dan Rather speak about last week in Seattle, where he says reporters, want that comfortable access to power, and so the New York Times goes to the White House and George Bush and his compadres say, don't run the story? Are we talking really about an access issue rather than, shall we say, journalistic principles?
Well, I don't think you can use that argument or that particular case in terms of the New York Times. I mean, who's bigger and who has more clout?
But you can say,
I think that the Times, and I would like to give them the benefit of the doubt, that it was in deference to national security. Since they haven't really disclosed, other than the book coming out, why they decided to go ahead with the story, is that perhaps there was something or someone that is on that list that the NSA has that they feel perhaps is on their unethically, illegally, and so that this needed to be brought out.
That phone number to call again, 1-800-441-2941. And Ken Siebert, you're in Billings. Feel free to jump in when we have a caller on the line.
Will do.
You know, the Jim West story continues to embroil Spokane. He has been recalled from office. And in fact, on February 8 in Spokane on Wednesday at Whitworth College, there's going to be a public panel, a public forum on the Spokesman Review's Jim West coverage, sponsored by the Washington News Council, interestingly enough, of which Larry Calley is a founding member. Karen Dorn Steele, you and Bill Moreland covered that story, and as I was doing my research, the Society of Professional Journalists, they say in their code of ethics, you should not use surreptitious means to get information unless there's no other alternative. The Spokesman Review did hire a computer expert to basically offer the opportunity for Jim West on city-owned computers to make his contacts with gay websites. In retrospect, how did you reach that decision as a newspaper, and do you have ethical concerns tonight about that decision?
I don't. I'd still defend it today, just as when we made the decision, but it was not made lightly, George. We had two young men already that we had identified through shoe leather reporting. That's my colleague, Bill Moreland, who had said that they had met the mayor online. Remember, this is the mayor of Spokane, who was the Republican majority leader of the Washington State Senate until he became mayor, ran as a family values Republican, and now is ostensibly showing up on gay websites of soliciting dates and sex with young men. We felt in good conscience we could not run that story based on allegations by two teenage unidentified young men. I mean, we knew who we were, but we could not use their names. We went the extra step to hire the forensic expert to corroborate absolutely that the person that we were dealing with on that website was our mayor. We also went to the Poynter Institute before publication, our editors did, and went through their checklist of justifiable to use a ruse. We also, in terms of our forensic expert himself, he did not know who we were looking for.
He did not know.
Okay. He had one specific task from us, identify the person using particular names on this website. That's how we set it up, George.
Dan Foley, as not only a former working reporter, but someone who teaches journalism, and in fact, a lot of your research involves the criminal justice system and its relationship to the news media. How do you feel about what the Spokesman Review did on the Jim West story?
Well, I think that what she said is absolutely correct, that it would be very difficult to do this story on the basis of two anonymous sources. I guess as an editor, I would have, this is really kind of a tough call. first of all, whether you go after this story and what the public interest justifications are for it, and second, how much resources you devote to a story like this, knowing that you're therefore not covering some other story or some other thing that's going on. So I think it's a pretty tough call on this one. I think it was a fairly gutsy call on the part of the Spokesman Review to do it.
You also have to realize that the context for this was much broader. We just like Seattle and Portland, have just been coming out of the maelstrom of the Catholic sex abuse story. And actually, that's where our tips first came from. In the beginning of this story was, don't just stop at the Catholic Church. Look at the other institutions around them, including the police department, powerful politicians, and other people in Spokane who protected them.
I don't think ethics is so much an issue here, because it's an investigation, and you go by whatever means you feel is necessary, are necessary, and that the fact that it was unethical for you to, quote, entrap him, if he was involved in an illegal, unethical activity, then I think that you can use a legal, perhaps perceived as unethical journalistically, but certainly not illegal means to find out what is actually going on.
And in terms of the entrapment issue, we also were very specifically said to our forensic person, do not engage this this person on the website. Post the profile of a 17-year-old about to be 18-year-old young man and see what happens. The mayor approached the profile.
I would like to go into the whole area, too, of public figures versus private individuals. And like a story like the Jim West story, he obviously is a public figure, a mayor, a former majority leader of the state Senate in Washington State. Dan Foley, what does a public figure give up when he or she is in the public light as far as privacy and things that perhaps an individual who is not in elected office or does not host a television show, this private individual, do they have more protection?
It seems to me in this particular case, the relevant question is whether these activities related in some way to his public duties. Had he done this on his own computer and without offering any sort of inducement that he had because he was a public official, you might have it in a different category than here, where he was using public facilities, and it seems to me the crucial thing here is that he was offering internships, something that he had available to him as a public official, as an inducement to commit what possibly could be a crime, or at least is unethical, seeking sexual favors from a minor. And I think the offer of the internship here was very crucial in terms of a decision on whether or not to use the story.
If you have comments to make about ethics in the news media, please call us now at 1-800-441-2941. And ethics in the news media is our topic tonight on Deadline 24/7. Just a reminder once again that News Council panel on the Spokesman Review's coverage of the Jim West story is Wednesday, February 8th at Whitworth College in Weyerhaeuser Hall from 7 to 9 p.m. The public is invited. Among the panelists, Jack Garrity, former Spokane mayor, Ted McGregor, editor and publisher of the Inlander, which is a Spokane independent newspaper, and Steve Smith, editor of the Spokesman Review. And just for the record, according to the Washington News Council, Jim West was invited to attend and declined. Any phone calls, Ken?
No, we don't have any phone calls, but I do have a quick question. I'd like to...
Please go right ahead.
Go to something that Larry Kelly said about perception. The perception of being unethical. And I guess my question is for anyone on the panel, when ethics becomes a part of the story, obviously perception is an awful lot of the battle. What goes into actually when you yourself become part of the story in terms of an ethical challenge or people's perceptions of something that might be unethical? How do you go forward with that? How do you, Karen Dorn Steele mentioned that they went to the Poynter Institute before publication. When all of those things come out, is it essentially a CYA type situation, or is there a real interest in saying, look, this is in fact ethical?
Well, I don't know about ethic. Well, I won't take up that point. I think that in terms of what was done by the paper, and since I wasn't involved, I can jump here in here on Karen's side on this. I don't think that ethics and legality are necessarily the total benchmark here. I think there's also this question of this man's philosophy, his public image, the hypocrisy that apparently was quite prominent, and that needed to be pointed out. So it isn't just a question of ethics and legality, but also this man's attitude and what he perceived publicly, or how he was perceived publicly, which was basically living a two lives.
Our panelists tonight, Karen Doran-Steele, an investigative reporter with the Spokesman Review. Dan Foley joins us from Knoxville, Tennessee. He's on the faculty there in the School of Journalism at the University of Tennessee. And Larry Calley, a former television reporter and producer with King 5 in Seattle. He also worked at CREM here in Spokane and one of the founding members of the Washington News Council. You know, we've had a recent incident with a very tragic wounding of ABC network correspondents in Baghdad, near Baghdad, in Iraq. But my story and question goes to this, the ethics of embedded reporters. The story goes that Colin Powell, when he left Vietnam, said that, among others, in the Pentagon, that they would never, as the military establishment, never allow the news media again to cover a war like we had access to coverage in Vietnam, where people basically went out on their own and covered the story. First in the Gulf War and now in Iraq, we have what is called embedded reporters, where they ride in military equipment, U.S. military equipment, and from time to time Iraqi equipment. The photographers, the reporters are embedded with the military for not only safety, but also for sources. And despite the tragic consequences of recent days and not only the continuing civilian accidents and tragic bombings that happened there, but what about, Karen Doran-Steele, the ethics of embedded reporters where they're riding with the military, living with the military, and that's how they cover wars?
Well, it's a real struggle for news organizations because in a place like Iraq, you almost cannot go on your own. It's really literally too dangerous. But to be embedded means that the government is controlling your message. And I'm suspicious of it, but I do understand why news organizations have taken up the opportunity to do it, too. The trouble is it's such a narrow window, and I think that reporters who live and work with soldiers for weeks on end naturally come to be protective of them and very, very sympathetic with what they do. And I think it's hard to maintain that slightly distant stance that reporters should do when you're embedded with a military unit.
Dan Foley, you're a Vietnam veteran, as is Larry Calley. What about the philosophy of embedding journalists with the military?
I was kind of skeptical when I found out that they were going to embed the reporters. I thought it worked a lot better than I would have anticipated. I thought we got a lot of news that we otherwise would not have had access to. That being said, if I were a major news organization, I would never agree that the price of embedding my reporters would be that I could not send other reporters out to cover the story who were not embedded. So I think a big news organization has to find a way to cover it, both from the standpoint of being embedded and from the standpoint of being more of a free to roam as they can in consideration of their own safety.
And I don't know, is that even allowed now in Iraq?
Well, I don't think anybody's embedded anymore, but it's such a dangerous place that it's pretty hard to get out into the countryside, and you're putting your life at jeopardy if you do.
Well, I know Jim O'Shea, one of the managing editors of the Chicago Tribune, and he said, and he manages and oversees the group that they have in Baghdad, and he has been telling us how almost impossible it is to do any real reporting, that security concerns are just paramount, and you really can't go anywhere. Look what happened to the Christian Science Monitor reporter, and she spoke Arabic.
Larry Calley.
Yeah, well, I think the embedded reporter, I doubt that there are any real covenants between the military and the news organization that they won't cover certain aspects of a raid or a battle. But you have to have access, and you have to have the military there with you. I think perhaps there is a reluctance on the part of the reporters to say something that is going to be negative But there have been instances where that has happened. I mean, you do see a battle firsthand, and you report what is happening. And I don't... technology is also a factor here, too. You know, in World War II, there were reporters embedded, but you didn't have the technology to get it out instantly. Now you do. And that's, of course, the danger, as far as the military is concerned, is if you're going to say something or you're going to see something that's going to be very detrimental to the government or to the military. But I think that's a chance you have to take. And I think it's up to the reporters individually to be able to use or exercise their own judgment and be as objective as they possibly can without feeling that they've got to compromise their journalistic stand in order to appease the military.
I rather suspect that if we'd have had a Me Lai type situation this time around, that it would have been reported.
I think so, too.
I think that's true. It's very different from the first embed that I know of in the 20th century. It was William Lawrence of the New York Times who went in when they dropped the first atomic bomb, and there was complete censorship, and complete censorship of all the photographs of the civilian casualties as well, and I think we've made progress since then.
We're talking about ethics and the news media, and your comments and opinions are welcome. Call us at 800-441-2941.
And George?
And Karen, yes, Ken?
George, we do have a phone call.
Well, please, we're on the air.
Caller from Spokane Valley, Washington.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Go right ahead.
Okay, I have a question, an ethical question that applies to the media as well as a number of other institutions, and that is some years ago, laws were passed all over the country in states, counties, etc., that required that any accusation of rape, and particularly child molestation, be reported to law enforcement. And the question that's missing from all the discussion in the coverage of the child molestation scandal in the Catholic Church is, where were state legislators and law enforcement and the media as the church was allowed to not specifically not report priests who'd been accused of rape or molestation, but to respond internally by hiding the priests, moving them from place to place?
Karen Doran Steele.
Yeah, well, we're still trying to sort that out. Even our stories on the Jim West situation led to a boys' ranch in Spokane, Morningstar Boys Ranch, in which there are allegations of molestation, and these allegations were never reported or followed up by law enforcement, and the relationship between the department, now the Department of Social and Health Services, the police, and these organizations where there are vulnerable children, whether it's the church or a boys' home, have not been completely made clear yet.
I also think some of these mandatory reporting laws are of more recent vintage and mm-hmm. don't go back as far as some of the incidents in the Catholic right. Church. And also they apply only to certain professions, such as medical personnel and school personnel and things like that. I don't know that they broadly apply to every citizen.
And there's been a settlement proposed in Spokane by the Spokane Diocese that happened yesterday and is still under discussion with the litigants, including the diocese, right now in Spokane.
Yeah, and there's another question here, too, is how much did various news organizations around the country know about these various allegations years ago but refused to investigate? To say nothing of law enforcement, just the fact, and, you know, that there have been these accusations, and yet the news media didn't follow up on them, or they didn't go anywhere with them.
The number to call, 800-441-2941. You know, in a way, we have been very positive with the news media thus far in this hour about ethics, and I want to go around the table quickly about, Karen Doran Steele, first, in your mind, what are the big ethical challenges facing journalists today? What concerns you as a working reporter?
The corporate, the conglomerations of media interests concern me. The sometime conflicts of interest would appear to me at very large and influential papers such as the New York Times and the Washington Post, when star reporters like Bob Woodward and others are not being forthright with their editors about what they know. We can talk a little bit about the Valerie Plame situation if you want to. And situations like Judith Miller at the New York Times. Was she in jail for the good of the First Amendment, or was she in jail to protect an administration source? And I think it's the latter.
Dan Foley, what about you?
The only thing that the news media has to offer the public is its credibility. And if the public does not believe what it reads, what it hears, what it sees from the news media, then the news media is not serving any useful purpose. And I think some of the incidents that have been exposed in recent years have done horrendous damage to media credibility. And I think if we're going to continue to be useful, that we have to pay some attention to the ways that we gather information and who we protect, and the use of anonymous sources, and all sorts of things having to do with the relationships between the media and the people they're supposed to cover.
Larry Kelly.
Well, I think today, because of this sort of interdependence and actually almost I would call it incestuous media relations between print and the broadcast, television and radio, you have a lot of crossover with all these people, and you've developed a star system. And these people not only are seen, not only are read in various journals, newspapers or magazines, but then they're also seen on television. They're guests on radio, and so it's I think that has taken over. And in the case of Bob Woodward, I'm very critical of that, but I think he was trying to maintain his stay out of the picture, criticize the investigation, much of which he was involved in, but refused to admit.
And he was also writing a book at the time,
yes,
which apparently the net profits from the book go to him, not the Washington Post. Bob Woodward, Karen Dorn Steele, here's a star. Many people went to journalism schools because of Watergate, and here he is. He's a star lecturer. He's a spin master in Washington, D.C., and maybe the Washington Post newsroom sees him from time to time, but what about this type of celebrity journalist?
Well, to me, one of our newsroom value statements is, this is from our new editor, Steve Smith, we tell people what we know when we know it without fear or favor. We don't withhold it until the book deal comes out, 2 years later. Not that we would have a book deal here in Spokane like Bob Woodward, but still, I think it really gets in the way of newspapers, the media's fundamental responsibility, and that's to the citizens of this country.
George, we actually have four callers on the line.
Beautiful.
At the moment.
Well,
so
let's go to caller one and two, and we'll get the other two as well. Go ahead, Ken. Introduce the folks.
Yes, this is from Usk, Washington.
You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Paul, and I've got a question for your panelists. Do they think that there's been a change in the ethics of journalism anachronistically as the size of each media organization has grown? And do they tie it with, and then I guess the second part of that question would be, do they tie that, if they perceive a change in the ethics due to the size of the organization, do they perceive that change coming from, let's say, the monetary driven to side to make more money off the news, let's say today as compared to 50 years ago, or is it just inherent in that size of bureaucracy that ethics change?
Dan Foley at the University of Tennessee School of Journalism, what about that?
I don't know if the ethics have changed or if now the unethical conduct is being exposed more than it previously was. Now, you talk about relationships with sources. Well, there was a time when reporters knew a lot about the conduct of the people that they covered, and they would not report it, particularly having to do with things like drinking and things of that behavior. In terms of the big companies and big money and so forth, I think that the pressure from Wall Street to report increasing profits every year that has resulted in reducing the size of our newsrooms has had a big impact on what sort of things that we cover. But on the other hand, I don't know that the problems are greater in big media than in small media. It's very costly to do investigative reporting, and it has to be done very carefully. And often it's the big media that have the resources to do that sort of reporting, whereas the average weekly newspaper might not have the sorts of resources to be a check on a mayor as the New York Times or the Washington Post or CBS do.
You know, as I've done this series based primarily in the Mountain West, it's been very interesting to note that Spokesman Review is one of the few news organizations, other than the Seattle Times, et cetera, that has an investigative unit, Bill Moreland and Karen Doran Steele. When you talk to some of the television stations in the biz today, some of them don't even cover the state legislature, let alone their congressional representatives in D.C. And so it's a very interesting mix of news we get these days. And we have another caller, Ken Siebert. Let's go there.
Yes, we do, from Spokane, Washington.
You're on the air.
Hello, is this me?
Yes, it is.
It is.
I'm sorry, this may be an untimely call, because I wanted to just make an inquiry of Karen Doran Steele regarding the decision to bring in the third party to identify Jim West. And I'm just wondering, in the deliberations, what... Was any consideration given to what would happen if it turned out that the person that was identified for corroboration turned out not to be Jim West but some other citizen? What's the duty of the newspaper in that instance, or what were the consequences considered, if any? And I'd be happy to just listen off the air, if that's okay.
And here's Karen Doran Steele.
Sure. If it had been a private person engaging in private conversations with another private person, it probably would not have led to a story. If it had been some other public official, say it hadn't been the mayor but someone else, then we would have pursued it, to wherever it went. But it was the fact that it was a public official that we suspected, offering perhaps public perquisites to young people that drove this story. And you never know in these stories where they're going to go. If we hadn't made that corroboration, we might never have published anything. There were various checkpoints along the way that we all discussed, the editors and the reporters, and it just happened that these stories eventually did see print.
You're listening to Deadline 24/7, the news business. We're live from Spokane and Billings, and the program is partially underwritten by Central Washington University in Ellensburg. Ken, we have another caller?
Yes, we do, from Newman Lake, Washington.
How you doing?
On the air. Good. How are you?
Doing very well. I had a very quick question. I'm sort of on my way home and about to go out of range. To the panel, basically, what is the view on everyone with blogs, and also journalists that are involving themselves more and more often with blogging as well as reporting stories? There seems to be a real high interest level, especially on the internet and with all this new media, on blogs, and where's their contribution? And also, sort of secondly, as a comment, I've noticed that there's been a lot of interest very recently in documentaries tying themselves into media and sort of the distortions of media, things like films like Outfoxed and the whole Rupert Murdoch issue as well. And just sort of a question, where does this all fall in when it comes to this conversation? And I'll just pop off the air now and see what you guys think.
Thank you. Stop your car. And here's Dan Foley with a response. Dan, you're teaching really cross-media, internet, broadcast, and print. You heard the question. What's the impact?
Well, that's really an interesting question, and it'll be interesting to see how it all sorts out. Now, for the most part, blogs are not doing original reporting. They're doing more commentary, and they're going out and they're grabbing information that's already been published here and there, and some of them do an absolutely splendid job on it. And I think where we've heard a lot of things about blogs are where what do they call the established media, I can't think of it, they have kind of a funny term for it, but where Dan Rather reports something and they quickly, through their interchanges, to find out that some of what he reported is in fact not true. So they've been a kind of an interesting check on the media. On the other hand, a great percentage of what you read on blogs is unsubstantiated opinion. So we have to be a little bit more sophisticated. One of the things I am kind of curious about is whether this long-standing tradition of the past 150 years or so since the Civil War of the news media being trying to be objective, to report the news without inserting their own opinion, as good or as bad as that might be at some time. Whether that's just whether with citizen journalism that is just going to be gone, because most of what you read on the web is based not on some degree of objectivity, but rather opinion.
Larry Kelly.
Well, I think it's sort of like we say to the consumer, the reader beware. I mean, you have to be discriminating in what you read, and people are going to read, especially in terms of the blogs, what they want to, and to reinforce their particular view. I think it's a matter of just being discriminating.
The number to call, 1-800-441-2941 with your questions. Ken Siebert in Billings, another caller?
Yes, we do. But before we do that, I'd just like to break in and say one of the things that I think has worked very well for the blogs is a sort of swagger, and I guess snark is the word for it, in showing up a lot of the ironies or the absurdities that present themselves both with politicians and also with the news media. And I think a lot of that has to do with the popularity of programs like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. There's been a huge buzz around the word truthiness at the end of the year. And I think that that word, truthiness, definitely falls in with the discussion we're having tonight. The caller we're going to next is East Helena, Montana.
Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I agree with, I think it was Larry that said that the press in particular doesn't have credibility. If it doesn't have credibility, it doesn't have much, and people will let it go. But my concern here is to try to probe the relationship between mainstream press, say like the Spokane paper, and a whistleblower. Let's say in East Helena, for example, that someone at the smelter there knew that there was a great deal of lead going out of those stacks. Maybe the Helena Independent Record, the local newspaper, needed to explore that before it did. Or, say, a scientist at Hanford or a scientist in Hamilton where that biological research or biological weapons research lab perhaps is going up. My concern is, how does the paper choose its whistleblowers, which story to explore, and how do you protect the whistleblower?
That's a very good question, and Karen Dorn-Steele, please.
Yeah, whistleblowers are very important. It is important for whistleblowers to be able to lead us to some kind of documentation, paper trails, not just have stories. I've used whistleblowers for years at Hanford and in other projects. They're invaluable, even in these large national stories like the one that that James Risen of the New York Times just broke about the NSA secret surveillance. That information, he told me, because I'm doing a story on it for this weekend's paper, told me came from NSA whistleblowers, sources within the agency that were very troubled with what was happening. This is an extremely important source of information, and I am troubled by the increasing tendency by the courts and by the White House too to try to crack down on the leakers instead of fix the problems.
Dan Foley, not only were you in Montana for several years with the Lee newspapers, but you also have reported from the Beltway, Washington, D.C., the magic Tower of Power. What about this reluctance of reporters to really take on a story? Have you had any personal experiences with that when you've had editors that said, not now, Dan, please go away?
Not while I was with the Lee papers. They always wanted me to very aggressively report the news. I did have some incidents when I was with Copley where I thought that things other than news values might have overridden good decision-making in the newsroom, which is one of the reasons why perhaps I didn't work for them for very long.
I also have to ask the question... you're, to my knowledge, the only one of the panel members who has actually worked for an elected official, Max Baucus, who is now senator in Montana. When you worked for him, he was congressman for the state of Montana. And we're certainly not picking on Max here, but is that a different world for a journalist to work within the political circle of, an elected official? What's that game like?
Well, it was a different world for me.
I only worked for him a short time, and I quickly had the feeling I was on the wrong side. And it wasn't because of anything at all about Max Baucus, who I think is a wonderful man and a great public servant. But I just felt very uncomfortable on that side. Now, there's lots of folks who can work in politics, and I thought I was going to love it. I really did. But I just felt like I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing when I was inside instead of outside covering it.
Did you ever feel compromised?
Compromised? You mean as a because I was working for
because
a politician?
Because you were acting as the liaison for an elected official with the media. Did you ever feel that you?
Well, I didn't do very much of that. I was a legislative assistant, and so I did some small dealings with the news media, but I was not his spokesperson or anything like that. So I probably would have really been uncomfortable doing that.
1-800-441-2941 is the phone number to call with your questions and comments. Ken, do we have another caller?
Yes, we do. We have a caller from Spokane.
Please, you're on the air.
I believe Dan Foley will bear me out on the history of reporting from Vietnam without benefit of embedding that for many, many more years, reporters were largely free to go where they wanted without being targeted by one side or the other. I mean, of course, there was always the risks inherent in war, but they weren't targeted, and they were they reported and did their job, and the Americans, the rest of the world got the story without, as I said, the benefit of embedding. Embedding on one side without embedding on the other constitutes, in my opinion, prima facie evidence of bias. It's not implemented to protect the reporter so much as to protect the public from what the reporter might see and report on from the other side. And that bias, that embedding leading to the bias, whether it's true or not, is part and parcel of why it became so dangerous for reporters in Iraq, because they were viewed in much the same way as the United Nations and the Red Cross had come to be viewed as biased participants in this aggression in Iraq.
And let's go to Dan Foley first with a comment on that issue. Dan, you were in Vietnam. You've been a working reporter. You heard what he had to say.
Well, I was, of course, not a reporter when I was in Vietnam. I was in the Army. In my recollection, and again, this was not from firsthand experience, while they did not call it embedding then, the way that a lot of the reporters got around there was they'd go out to the airport and they'd hitch a ride with somebody from the military, get on a helicopter, just beg their way onto a ride if they wanted to go somewhere. So it was a very informal sort of arrangement, but it was a lot safer to travel in a helicopter than it was to get in a Jeep or in a truck and travel on some of the roads.
Larry Calley, you too were in Vietnam.
Well, I was going to say, I think embedding is probably, it's not a very good term. For one thing, it sounds like you're in bed with.
Well.
And I think, you know, having,
I think that was the caller's point.
I think it is. It is. Unfortunately, I think it's euphemistically probably not accurate. I think assigned to a particular unit would have been a better choice of words, because embedded does sound like you are there at their bidding, and that's not accurate, or shouldn't be accurate.
Karen Doran Steele.
There's a very interesting film. It's called Control Room, mm-hmm. and it is from the perspective of Al Jazeera, one of the Arab news organizations that's been trying to cover the Iraq war. And I'm not close enough to the situation to say who's right and who's wrong, but this movie strongly suggests that we have, if not deliberately, at least accidentally, killed some of the Al Jazeera journalists because we did not like what they were reporting. It's very interesting whose perspective you get, and the rest of the world has very different perspectives on this conflict than we do, and I don't think that embedding helps that at all.
You're listening to Deadline 24/7, the news business. Tonight, ethics and the news media. Our guests, Karen Doran Steele of the Spokesman Review, Dan Foley, University of Tennessee School of Journalism in Knoxville, and Larry Calley, one of the founding members of the Washington News Council, also a former television reporter and producer at King 5 in Seattle and Krim in Spokane. Ken, additional callers.
Yes, we have a caller from Billings, Montana.
All right, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like to switch gears for a second and go more to local news.
Does
a private citizen do to, well, rather, you see a bias in the newspaper, and it's totally biased one way. How do you try to correct it or go after it with better information so you get better information?
I'm going to tell a personal story that I hope she doesn't mind. Dr. Janine Peace, who is an enrolled member of the Crow Agency in Montana, American Indian. She also, as you know, probably is on the administration of Rocky Mountain College. She told me recently how she and several American Indian leaders in the Billings and Eastern Montana area went and met with the editor and the publisher of the Billings Gazette with that very point. She was saying, Dr. Peace was saying, that there's more to American Indian news than the police beat and the crime page. And she was surprised and positive that they got some results. They got two people, the publisher of the Gazette and the editor, to sit down and spend not only some time with them, but actually do some follow-up. It may not be, in some cases, always that easy. Karen Doran Steele, any advice?
Well, at least our paper invites the public to its morning news meetings. That is a way to see how the process plays out, what gets on page one, what gets on the regional pages. And there are other avenues, too, that we have with our editors where people can complain and air their grievances.
Ken Siebert in Billings, any phone calls standing by?
Not at the moment.
Okay, let's good Larry. Callie,
well,
go ahead.
I want to go back to an earlier caller. I think it was Paul who called, and he's asking about the blogs and the impact that they're having on the media. And I think it really boils down to competition. It is a monetary thing. Newspapers are going after a shrinking customer base. Television and radio stations are trying to get a bigger piece of a shrinking pie. So you're all trying to get the big story, and the competition is so keen, and there's such a desire to be first with a story that I do think there is a tendency for us to, in the media, and I'm speaking generally speaking, for us to go with limited information sometimes. Not that the story isn't accurate, but it may not be complete. So I think competition is the biggest driver right now in terms of getting people to read or to listen or to watch.
And in many newspapers, the paragraphs are like an 8-graph story. That's a news story. In television, if you have a 2-minute news story as a complete individual story on a local newscast, you're lucky. And so the brevity, they always make fun of USA Today, but on the other hand, sometimes you wonder about where our attention span as a society is going. Dan, I want to go back to one of the points made by the caller from Billings. He was saying, how do we get our voice heard in the newsroom? I want to talk about the infamy or perhaps the credibility of news consuls in the United States. Washington State does have a news consul. Larry Calley was a founding member. We'll go to him in just a moment. But journalists per se, at least in my circle of contacts, are very critical of news consuls. They are very, suspect of why do we want this independent group that is going to have, quote, case hearings about accuracy and fairness in news on particular stories. What do you think about the news consul per se as a way for the general public to have some access to having their comments heard on fairness and accuracy?
Well, I think as long as there are things in place so that if somebody wants to have a case go before the news council, that they agree that whatever the news council decision makes, that will be the end of it, that they will not then turn around and say go to a court of law and sue somebody for libel or something of that nature, because I don't think that you can expect the media to expose themselves to something like that. But I think on the whole, if if it's a fair hearing, it can be a very positive sort of thing. And you were mentioning that that the Washington News Council is going to have this thing at Whitworth College on the Spokane mayor thing, and that sounds like a wonderful thing. I wish I could be there to hear what the public has to say. So, if you get into something like this, it can take a lot of your resources. I mean, if you're busy trying to respond to something from a news council, that means that you're not out covering some news story on that day. So that is the disadvantage. The advantage is that the fact that you're willing to do that and be accountable to the public reinforces your credibility. And if you're not willing to do it, the public can have a rightful reason to be skeptical about whether you're being careful if you're afraid to defend it.
And as we go to the top of the hour, briefly, just first of all, on that February 8 event here in Spokane at Whitworth College in the evening at 7, that's a panel discussion. It's not a case hearing. That should be kept very clear. Ari Calley, on the other hand, you were one of the volunteer members who created the Washington State News Council. There are only two of them, Washington State and Minnesota, a weak one, I understand, in Hawaii. As a former reporter, why did you say, hey, I want to be part of this?
Well, because, and I wanted to get back to what Dan said, just to, for our audience, for clarification. Dan, in terms of the news council, and I'm sure this is true of all the news councils, all two or three of them that there are in the U.S., is that if a person does have a complaint, and we're talking about the hearing process here, is that they have to agree that they will not file suit, that they will not use a decision from the news council as fuel for their fight against the news media. I got involved because I honestly believe that the public did need a chance to be able to air their concerns. And if you felt wrong, you had no choice except to go to the courts, which could be very costly. And in more cases than not, you'd probably lose. Now, that doesn't mean that you were wrong and the newspaper was right. But you go to court on a legal issue. It's not an ethical or a moral one. With the news councils, you do approach a complaint on those fairness, accuracy, and ethics. And I think that news councils can serve a very good purpose in that regard, as far as the public.
And Karen Dorn-Steele, you on an earlier program on this series were very critical of the news council concept.
I've been skeptical of news councils as a concept. For one thing, the press in our country is very independent. We don't, you know, submit to licensing by anybody. The fact that there are only three news councils and there are 50 states is fairly telling. I think lots of newspapers feel the same way. They just don't want that. And yet I would not be so arrogant as to say we should never have discussions about bias and accuracy. But the thing that troubles me the most about the news councils is their corporate funding. I do not like to see Microsoft's and Boeing's and even the state's major PR firms chipping in, and I don't know all the details of the funding, so I could be inaccurate here, but I don't like to, when I look at that lineup, I don't like that because there's an agenda there. When corporations weigh in with a lot of money, there is an agenda. What is it?
Mean Bill Gates? Larry
Keller? Well, I would respond to that, again, because I was a part of the news council, that it isn't so much where the funding comes from, but the people who are involved in it. And if you've got a diversity of people with various interests on a news council, which I think the Washington State News Council does have, I think you want to look at who those people are. And you would look at the decisions that they make, and you never find that they're unanimous or that they're heavily weighed toward industry or any particular interest group. I think you have to look at that rather than where the money's coming from.
And as a case in point, as we move forward...
They tell us, though, always to follow the money in journalism, Larry.
1-800-441-2941 is the
number. Could I pipe in on the news council?
Please do, Dan. Yeah.
It seems to me that one of the big advantages of the news council is that it gives the public a place to go to get a fair hearing.
Yeah.
Some professors at the University of Tennessee did a study, it's probably been 20 years ago now, on libel. And they went around and they talked to a bunch of people in the business, and they talked to a bunch of people that had filed libel suits and that had grievances against newspapers. And one of the interesting things that they discovered is that oftentimes, and now this is particularly ordinary citizens, had filed libel suits against newspapers because they couldn't get the newspaper to respond in any meaningful way to their grievance. What they wanted was not money from the newspaper. They wanted vindication. They wanted somebody to say, I was done wrong, what was in the newspaper was incorrect, and they were turned down. The editors wouldn't talk to them or paid no attention to them. So I think that this dialogue that we see going on between editors and readers is very beneficial.
And that's Dan Foley from the University of Tennessee School of Journalism. Ken Siebert, do we have a caller standing by?
At this point, we do not.
Okay, the number to call, 1-800-441-2941. And what about a basic, like fact-checking and source verification? Karen Dornsteel, in your investigative reporting, ranging from the nuclear industry to Jim West and beyond, do you want what? Double sources, triple sources? How do you verify truth in the nebulous sense of what is truth? But how do you verify sources?
Well, a lot of my work is based on documents. Like when we tried to look at Hanford and had it been a hazard in its past, we used the Freedom of Information Act. We got lots of documents. Ultimately, at first they fought us. You know, they said they were classified. We couldn't have them. Well, we finally got them. They told the story that Hanford, in the course of making weapons, making plutonium, had contaminated eastern Washington with rather massive doses of radiation. It's very important to have documentation and then develop credible sources. And of course, we try to have as many credible sources. And we've talked about the Jim West story and how we went to extra lengths to get an additional corroboration for that story.
Larry Kelly.
Well, I think a bigger concern, and of course, with an investigative reporting, you do have time.
Right.
I think the more pressing issue is because of the immediacy that is now a big factor in terms of television and the newspapers to some degree as well, radio and television and the newspapers, is that you go with the story without checking your sources because you've got a breaking story. You don't have all the facts, but you got to get it on the air, and you could be
live
wrong.
Cameras, live video feed, satellite feeds. Dan Foley, we have 2 minutes left. Thoughts on your mind about this issue?
I don't know that the number of sources is as crucial as the documentation. I mean, if you've got the documentation, it doesn't make any difference how many sources you've got. And there was something that came out of Watergate, and particularly the movie about it, that was called the two-source rule. And Woodward and Bernstein had this this sort of guideline that they would not use an anonymous source unless it was independently verified. They would not use an anonymous source solely as the basis for a story unless they got verification from another independent source, which was, I guess, kind of a good guideline. But if you have two sources and they're both wrong, that still doesn't make it right.
That's
so the
true.
Number is not as important as being able to document it in some way. The two-source rule put in some checks against one source being wrong. I mean, it gave you a way to prevent mistakes, but just because two people say the same thing doesn't mean it's right either.
And on that note, we have to conclude this program. It's been a wonderful discussion. Karen Dornsteel, investigative reporter for the Spokesman Review, thank you very much for joining us. Dan Foley from Knoxville, the University of Tennessee School of Journalism, and a former Montanan, worked for many years with the Lee newspapers in Montana. Larry Kelly, a now retired television reporter and producer in Seattle with King 5. He won 4 Emmys. He's now a media consultant and, as you heard, a founding member of the Washington News Council. Larry, thank you for traveling with us and being with us in Spokane. A special thank you to Ken Siebert of Yellowstone Public Radio and Doug Nadvornik of Spokane Public Radio. This is the final program in our mini-series of Deadline 24/7, The News Business. We've had 5 interesting hours, and we hope that you, the listener and callers and observers, thank you so much for being part of this series. And I'm George Cole. We hope to talk with you soon.
For more information on this program and to listen to streaming audio of this and previous programs in the series, visit www.ypradio.org.
This program is supported in part by Central Washington University in Ellensburg, a member of the Western Undergraduate Exchange. Visit them on the web at cwu.edu.